Tonight on Arena, Loa looks to revolutionary poetry for the songs on her new EP, When I Rise Up, and Empty House, a new anthology of poetry and prose on the climate crisis. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. Sally Garnett, better known as Loa, has announced her new EP of poetry from the 1920s, set to music, with her first single, The Body to the Soul by Eva Gore Booth, being released today. Loa was about to move to New York last year before the pandemic hit, but she stayed in Ireland, where she continued to work as a pharmacist and also on the release of these new poems and songs. Delighted to have Loa join us on the programme this evening. 2020, Loa, certainly not the year that any of us expected, but you had great plans to move to New York in 2020, but you shelved all of that. What was the ultimate reason for shelving it? Was it just too difficult to go at the moment, or did you want to continue in that pharmacist role? Because that role was hugely important for the last year for all of us.
Well, I think it was a combination of both. Probably New York wasn't maybe the ideal place to be. I think a lot of people were trying to get out of New York in 2020.
Yeah.
So it would have been maybe a fool's errand to be trying to rush in. And I was going there to pursue a career in the arts. And obviously we all know what's happened for the arts in the past year. So and you know, I did train as a chemist, and funnily enough, I'd gone into my old boss to bid my farewell, and I was back in there a week later, you know, with the idea of only being in there for like maybe a month until it all blew over, which I think we all really genuinely believed it would. And then it became pretty clear that it wasn't going to be a good idea to go to emigrate, and I just kept working, and I've been there for the past year actually.
And doing, as I say, working on this mini album and these songs in the meantime as well.
Yeah.
Had it been your thought, Loa, that if you did got to go to New York in March 2020, was this the project, was this one of the projects that was on your mind, this revisiting poetry from the 1920s?
Not in a million years. This is completely down to, you know, the Billy Ray Cyrus. I had no such intentions. I was actually going to work on my first album with producers in the States, and I kind of was just going to start gigging and doing the, you know, hustling, as they call it. But I read a lot of poetry, and I generally write from poetry and respond to it. So I'm always like reading poems all the time. And actually, because the Arts Council put out that kind of COVID emergency relief, that I don't really know where the idea came from. It's something that I always intended to do in a much later stage of my career, I think. I really saw myself doing maybe even a double album of poetry. And for some reason, maybe it was the quiet repose of being at home all the time, and I was reading a lot of poems to kind of give myself like something to keep my mind, I guess, some solace. It just popped into my head, and he said, you know what, I'll make the application. And then I got stuck in, and I specifically chose poems from that period, because I just felt like there's this really interesting, I suppose, reflection 100 years on. Like, they'd come out of the Spanish flu and the war, and there's a lot of tumult in their time as well. So I found it very comforting.
And in fact, I think it was the specifics of a Yeats poem, In Memory of Eva Gore Booth and Countess Markovics, that specifically sent you off to explore more about Eva Gore Booth.
Well, I mean, I always, like, we all learn that poem, like, you know, at the beginning of our careers in school. So I knew who she was, and I knew, like, she existed. But it was when I was looking up poets from the time, and I spoke to Michael O'Loughlin, the poet, and we had a really good chat about that period and modernist poetry. And he was like, he mentioned Eva Gore Booth, and I was like, oh God, yes, she was that writing in that time as well. I guess I thought of her as being, and not necessarily being a contemporary of that moment, but because it was like the latter stage of her life, you know. But so that set me off, and I already knew the Harlem Renaissance I was obviously going to kind of tap into that. So it was really the Irish, it opened up so much Irish poetry that I hadn't considered, or that isn't like at the forefront of the canon, and particularly, you know, Eva Gore Booth, Catherine Tynan pops up there as well, and Yeats.
So Eva Gore Booth, Catherine Tynan, and Yeats. And you mentioned there that you also went to Harlem to look for some poetry there, as in you imaginatively went, in your imagination, you traveled to Harlem to get some poems there. And Georgia Douglas Johnson, you found there. And there was one other, a Sierra Leonean poet as well, referring to another aspect of your own background.
absolutely. Well, I felt like I was trying to, I guess, like escape my house in the stanzas on the page, because, you know, I felt like I wanted to sort of have an interaction with America in a nice way that wasn't as triggering as like trying to imagine modern music. So I was really great. I reread a lot of Langston Hughes, who's in there, Georgia Duk-Astanshin, who I wasn't that familiar with, but she was amazing. She had this salon in Washington, D.C., where all these African-American poets who were on tour during the Harlem Renaissance would pop in at her salon in her living room and talk and smoke into the night about poetry and you know, civil rights and all the good fun stuff. So she's cool. I actually ended up doing two of her poems, and the poem When I Rise Up gives the EP its name. And then also, yeah, Gladys Casely Hayford, who was Sierra Leonean, but she was so cool because she actually kind of ran away with the jazz band when she was supposed to be in college in Berlin, much to her parents' irritation. And she ended up writing poetry and on tour, and also met all the Harlem Renaissance poets. So there's this really nice kind of like connection between all of them, and I felt like it was all my, you know, my elders kind of, you know, speaking to me from beyond. So it was a really fun project.
Yeah, because I suppose in many ways Eva Gorbooth maybe suffers from being seen as a person in relation to the poetry of W.B. Yeats, yeah, but she absolutely had so much of her own activism, her own work, her own writing. There was so much involved there that maybe her writing is overlooked. What did you discover about her and find out about her that particularly excited you? Because as you described the others, Eva Gorbooth fits into that category, really, doesn't she?
Oh my God, what a woman. I mean, what didn't I discover? Like, I feel like she deserves her own section in the curriculum, because she, it's so funny, because in the modern era we're talking so much about, like, say, you know, there's always workers' rights and making sure that we live in a fair society, and herself and her, I guess, alleged partner Esther Roper, they did all this work for like labor activism and women in factories. She had all these kind of really far out ideas about gender and I guess probably was maybe related to her own relationship with Esther Roper, but that's always kind of, it's never been clarified. But she was really, really ahead of her time, and she was writing about things that now still are kind of revolutionary. So she was like light years ahead, and in a, you know, and she was a revolutionary for Ireland, and was there at the founding of the nation. So she's like this huge figure, and it's no surprise Yeats wrote a poem about her. I mean, she's like the ultimate muse, but she didn't even need to write a poem about him, you know what I mean? She was too busy, like, you know, going around like showing up in senates and arguing with people and demanding rights for the proletariat, as it were, or whatever. So I could have done a whole album of just Eva Gorbooth, and it was really hard to choose one poem, but I kind of went for this one because I felt it had a really nice ethereal quality that matched the rest of the work. But anyone listening, I really encourage you to go and look into her stuff, because she's really spiritual, really practical, and really exciting.
Well, we listen to the body, to the soul now, Loa, but before we do that, maybe you tell us what it was specifically about this poem that that caught your imagination and that made you choose it for the one that you had set to music.
Yeah, so what I love about this poem is that on first glance, it looks like a kind of a serious poem, like, you know, the body, the soul, all these like big themes. But actually, it's kind of this really almost funny, sarcastic argument between the body and the soul. The body is like giving out to the soul for dragging it through all this turmoil and drama, and then, you know, just throwing it in the ground after, and the soul gets to live forever. And the body's kind of like, wow, thanks, you know, and you would bury me like a thing of shame, you know. And it's really like it takes in all these themes about death and kind of the fleetingness of life and everything that we experience in it from this really interesting perspective. So it's got humor, it's got depth, and it's also just beautiful, you know. And I only chose a few stanzas for the song. It's much longer, so it was really exciting, even just that process alone. It was
To choose, listen, I'll finish up by listening to what about the New York plans? Are they just pushed further down the line now?
I think in this time, I don't think it's wise to make any plans. I think we go on a week-to-week basis.
Yeah, I'm agreeing now to plan to play the song in 10 seconds, so I'll stick with that plan. Great to speak with you this evening, Loa. Thanks for talking to us.
Cheers. Thanks for having me on.
Not at all. That's okay. Loa. And let's hear then her version of The Body to the Soul, setting of the poetry of Eva Gorbooth. I will drag
you back from the starry spheres. Yay, down from the very bosom of God. You shall follow once more, a wandering fire. You shall gaze again on the starlit sea. You shall remember me.
Yeah, could have been written yesterday, the words as we hear them sung in that version of The Body to the Soul, the poetry of Eva Gore Booth, set to music by Loa, and that is from Loa's upcoming EP called When I Rise Up. Alice Kinsella and Nessa O'Mahony are the co-editors of Empty House, Poetry and Prose on the Climate Crisis. This is an anthology of new writing responding to that ever-looming worry. The new anthology contains a variety of non-fiction, fiction and poetry from both Irish and international authors, people like Jan Carson, Arnold Thomas Fanning and Jessica Traynor. But more notable, perhaps, is the multi-generational aspect of the anthology, with contributions from younger writers as well as more established household names. One of the editors, Nessa O'Mahony, and one of the contributors, Alan McMonagall, join me on this evening's programme. Nessa, I was reading the first line of Alice's introduction to the anthology, said, "Anxiety brought me to this book." Do you share that anxiety that Alice expresses in the opening section of the collection?
I did, but I think the difference between Alice and me, and it's possibly part of that generational thing that you were noticing in your own introduction, is that I'd probably be fatalistic and think dreadful things are happening, I might write a poem. Alice would see this and think dreadful things are happening, let's do something to try and change it. And that was essentially the mindset she came with to me when she suggested that we maybe look at co-editing an anthology. She had thought about it, thought through how it might be done. She'd already approached Thera Press, John and Lisa Walsh with the idea. And then she came to me because we had worked on another project and said, "What do you think? Could we do this?"
And you answered yes, obviously.
Well, no, knowing her and just knowing the dynamo she is, but the seriousness with which she brings to every project she was involved in, I was only too happy to get involved.
And the initial idea, I think, was to actually approach a number of agreed upon writers. It was the writers that were your starting point. What were your criteria in the choosing of those writers?
I think we thought that there were writers who we felt would respond seriously to the theme, that would have interesting things to say, that would sort of bring their own vision as well as deal with the subject matter. And you see that represented in the incredibly diverse range of pieces here. Very different styles, very different voices, very different subject matters, and yet all coming, you know, from different angles to this notion of a world that is slowly being destroyed by human activity.
And Alan then, Alan McMonagall, when you were approached with this idea that can you give us something that is about the climate crisis, the idea of writing around an issue, what was your initial or what were your thoughts around that?
Well, my first thoughts, I got an email, I think it was toward the tail end of 2019, and it was from Nessa's colleague and co-editor, Alice Kinsella, that the note came into me. What struck me was just how heartfelt and persuasive Alice was in her email. I mean, it was a very open-hearted note she sent to me, more or less outlining her concerns as to the plight of the planet, you know, global warming, climate change, threats to biodiversity, species extinction and so forth. She mentioned the publisher that she was aiming for to put out said anthology. And so really, to me, that was all I was hearing was great cause, great editors, great publishers, sign me up and thank you very much for asking.
But the idea, you know, the idea of writing with that word, with cause or issue or around, whatever way you want to put that idea, that because you have to address climate crisis and what you're doing, that I don't think is something that would be something you would necessarily see to the fore of your writing usually.
Yeah, you're probably right. I mean, I don't know if I would see myself as a quote-unquote message writer per se. But in this case, I did recall some time back writing a piece, Galway Set, and the big town, small city, whatever you want to call it, was under threat from a great flood. And I also recall the fashion of a wonderful piece by the British poet Lavinia Greenlaw. I mean, she writes with startling clarity and starkness and indeed humour about very real issues. And so when invited to contribute to this, I thought it might be a neat idea to write a companion Galway piece to my earlier effort. And rather than concentrating on a water-based theme this time, I decided to go to the other end, if you like, of the elemental spectrum. And so I conjured a fire, a great fire, a conflagration even. And actually, gorse fires, they're quite common near where I live, especially at this time of year, if we get a dry patch at all. So an extreme manifestation of such a fire seemed a likely way for me to go.
Yeah, but you wanted to, while it's obviously it's very serious points that you're making, some very serious points here, I think you wanted to have a sense of fun about it.
I did, of course. I mean, my attitude dabbles in farce, absurdity, exaggeration. I wanted to, you know, imbue a piece with my own style, sensibility, how I perceive and receive the world. I mean, once upon a time, I might have considered it an extreme perception, but now I'm not so sure.
Well, listen, will you read the opening section of the poem for us then?
I will indeed. As I say, it's a companion piece. Clue is in the title. I'll go about a quarter ways in. Further greetings from the future-proof city. Sister, I know it's been a while, but this time it's official. We are coming to visit for good. It's either that or slit our throats upon tuning in to the weather lady's latest debriefing. To be fair, there could be something in what she says. Salt Hill has disappeared. Before that, Barna, Spiddle, and every bit of Inishbofin. Alas, the corncrakes are no more. It could be worse, you may well say, but the galloping flames now have us firmly in their sights. Fiona French has packed her bags and legged it to Greenland for one last hurrah. And odd Doris is cooped up in her tunnel, inhaling a smoking compound of yoo-hoo glue, asbestos, retrograde mushrooms, and melted down plastic salvaged from the inside of a washed-up whale. It can only be better than what's offered on plein air, don't you know?
That's the opening section there of Alan McMonagall's poem, Further Greetings from the Future-Proof City, which is part of the new anthology we're speaking about this evening, Empty House. And particularly Nessa O'Mahony, Alan is with us, obviously, as is Nessa O'Mahony, one of the editors. Particularly when we hear Alan reading it, we get that lovely tongue-in-cheek tone that he has. And I guess you need a bit of that in the midst of this, because let's face it, climate crisis is... it's not something you can joke about too lightly, but you can't have... it can't be bleak the whole way through. Was that important in the choosing of the writers and how you went about compiling the anthology eventually?
I mean, very, very much so. I think we were very aware that we wanted a balance in tone and that we really wanted to try and show some sort of movement from despair to hope. There are some very funny pieces in this anthology. I'm thinking of Jan Carson's Mr. Iceberg is hilarious.
Just give us the setup that Jan gives us. That a kind of a she manages to get a kind of a magic realism into the whole thing in some ways, doesn't she? Which is her style in many ways.
She does. It's very mischievous. I mean, essentially there's a protagonist, a woman who's got this very ecologically aware but apparently very boring partner, and they go on this sightseeing holiday to Newfoundland where they're going out iceberg hunting, and it's during that voyage that she undergoes this quite extraordinary transformation herself. But it's Jan's classic sly wit throughout the story. But one of the ideas that we had, we sectioned the anthology by season.
Yeah.
Ending in spring with that hope that there is hope, there are things that can be done. And the final piece, which is an interview which Alice carried out with Oisin Coughlan of Friends of the Earth, very much emphasises what can still be done, whether it's at, you know, state level, at government level, or at individual level. So we were very anxious that this wouldn't be something that was just, you know, doomsaying, that
yes,
this was, we're looking at it clear-eyed, but we are able to point to ways where change is still possible.
Yeah, and very interesting, again, Alice in her introduction points out, Alan McMonagall, this idea that she was looking at, well, what can I do in this situation? You know, what are the tools that I have to do something or to say something? And the tool she had was as a writer and publisher and that particular area of things. I'm always wary about this idea, the responsibility of the writer, the duty of the writer. Does that play into this in any way, or did that play into it in any way for you when it came to deciding to do a piece here?
Well, I suppose I did jot down some words and phrases that were coming into my mind as I was working on my piece. I mean, for me, yeah, the starting point is always the writing and those imaginative leaps and bounds, whether it's, you know, whether those bounds are into the realm of farce and absurdity and humour. But, you know, like words were dropping onto my page, like bearing witness, cautionary, art is reparative, or it can be reparative. And indeed, that opening line from Alice's great introduction, anxiety brought me to this book. I mean, I that was one of the first things that really stayed with me when I began to read the anthology. It's something that chimes very nicely with Arnold Fanning's piece, somebody else you mentioned at the top
yes.
of the feature, How I Feel About Walking. I think Arnold's piece chimes very nicely with Alice's sentiment, this notion of anxiety.
Yeah, and in fact, Arnold's piece, I suppose, in lots of ways speaks to the COVID year that we're hopefully coming out of now at this point, when walking became such an important reliever of anxiety and stress for people.
Well, that's right. I mean, I do a fair bit of walking myself, but I'd no sooner, you know, the sooner the thought had entered into my head that it occurred to me, you know, the entire country has in the past 12 months done their fair share as well. But Arnold does make the point, you know, he, and via his lovely reflective and observational style and some lovely detail and descriptor of a couple of walks undertaken, mountain hike, forest trail, you know, he does demonstrate how walking, and in particular walking in nature, can help dissipate anxiety.
Yeah.
So it's a lovely marriage, if you like, of content and thematic consideration.
Yeah, and walking is there in a couple of the different stories and poems in the collection as well. But Nessa, coming back to you then, you mentioned this idea of having the four seasons as a kind of a sorting mechanism for you. I suppose that's always with an anthology, you have to find some sorting mechanism. Did you mention seasons to the writers, or did that organisational aspect come after the event?
That organisational aspect came afterwards, when we realised that there did seem to be a pattern within the submissions, and again, keen to try and find that way to offer hope. I think that the other wonderful addition here is the artwork.
Yeah.
Catherine Galvin's very fine illustrations, both between each section, but also this wonderful book cover. So it all just seemed to turn into this wonderful plan.
Will you read one of the poems that you suggested you might share with us this evening, which is the poem that opens the autumn section of the collection? This is A Villager Mourns the Bay from Anne-Marie Nicorain.
I will indeed. And it's interesting because Alan was talking about everybody out walking. There are lots of recurring themes. Mm. And there's a piece that Michael Viney writes, which he kindly let us use an excerpt from one of his regular Irish Times pieces. But he talks about this notion that in worst case scenarios, the west of Ireland may become in winter uninhabitable because of the level of winter storms. And this poem takes the perspective of somebody looking at a particular part of the western coastline up in Donegal, where Anne-Marie is from, and sort of blends this classic tradition of the Gaelic lament for a lost culture with a very contemporary lament for a lost ecology. Yeah. And she just does this in a wonderful way. So the poem is called A Villager Mourns the Bay. And there's an opening epigraph from Lady Gregory's translation of Donal Óg. You have taken what is before me and what is behind me, and my fear is great that you have taken God from me. Here lies a bay that haunts my throat like a lost calf. 37 noble paths I have rinsed from my mouth. This blue water on the edge of earth is the same water I was raised upon, and yet the tongue no longer speaks east from west in agreement with the sun. How now to say the convolutions of a ton? How to dream a lock inside a stone? How to call an assembly for the corncrake found on a cold dune of the Northwest Ocean? At the end of the language, there is only a boat too far out among rocks and the sunken names of kings who, vowel to the bone, defended the island in Suavness, Sullus, Fiontus.
And that's A Villager Mourns the Bay by Anne-Marie Nicorain, which is in the collection we're talking about, the anthology we're talking about this evening, Empty House, Poetry and Prose on the Climate Crisis. Nessa O'Mahony, one of the editors, and Alan McMonagall, one of the contributors with me this evening. That, as I say, opens the autumn section of the collection. I notice, Alan, that you are deep in the dark depths of winter with your piece. How did you feel about that allocation?
I have absolutely no problem with being put in winter. I often welcome the dark months, the early hours, the short days, the long nights. It's a time I welcome from the creative point of view. I can batten down the hatches, go into creative mode, and hopefully come out of hibernation come spring with something to show for the time.
I think I'm sure too that part of the reason that you're in that winter is the wonderful dark humour that is there within Further Greetings from the Future Proof City that we got a sample of earlier when you were reading for us. But finally, I wanted to ask you, Nessa, a little bit about quite a diversity of writers, both in terms of ethnic background, but particularly in terms of age. A couple of young writers here, Mia Darcy and Siobhan Fitzgerald. First of all, how did you go about getting your younger writers, and did you notice much difference from how the younger writers approached things to how the older writers approached things?
Well, I think it was very important to us that the younger voice was there. And again, I suppose, led to a certain extent by Greta Thunberg's amazing example of this poised, articulate young woman who put it up to the older people. We realised that there is a generation of very poised, articulate men and women out there who are already activists. I was driving in listening to a young woman on Drive Time who described herself as a political activist and who said that her top priority is climate change. So it matters to them. They're talking about it already. And we really wanted this anthology to be something that reflected all of that diversity. And so Siobhan Fitzgerald, who you mentioned, is actually the youngest contributor. I think she was 15 when she sent the poem in to us. She's still at school and she read this poem at the online launch a couple of weeks ago and just read it wonderfully. So if I'd had that confidence when I was 15, I would have been a very different person, I think.
And did you notice much difference between, I suppose, the younger generation in many ways are the people who will have to deal with more with the legacy than the older generation?
Yeah, I think they're not afraid, as I said, not afraid to put it up to us. And you know, her poem starts, "I am simply much too young. Too young to pray for a droplet of silken liquid, too young to cower from the window full of water." You know, if that wasn't a call to action, I don't know what is.
It certainly is that. And congratulations to her and indeed all involved. Thanks for speaking to us this evening. That's Nessa O'Mahony, co-editor of the anthology, and Alan McMonagle, one of the contributing writers. The anthology is called Empty House, Poetry and Prose on the Climate Crisis, and the collection, as we heard, is published by Thyra Press. An old man has three children. He also happens to have an entire kingdom. He's tired, he wants a rest, but how to divide up the spoils? Well, as we all know, King Lear doesn't make a great choice when it comes to that, but this is a theme played out over and over again and again, from Dallas through to Succession. Director Conor Hanratty has created a unique COVID-safe event to bring the key scenes from Shakespeare's King Lear alive, and it features Arthur Reardon as the great king with the big dilemma. Delighted to be joined this evening by both Arthur and Conor. Conor, the festival in a van, first of all, it started last year. Really good way of getting entertainment around the country and doing so within all the restrictions and staying safe in the process. Now, you directed Romeo and Juliet last year and now you're back with King Lear. But tell us a little bit about how festival in a van actually works.
Well, it came about last year because the brilliant Gemma Tipton had the notion of trying to resist the huge number of restrictions that have been upon us for so long at this point. So she got her hands on a van, and it's been to a great number of venues around the place, not just with theatre, but with a huge number of artists and different art forms, bringing a little, we hope, a little bit of joy here and there. And then, so I was brought on in September to direct Romeo and Juliet, which was, I think, one of the plays available to the junior cert students last year. And it was just such a joy, having been off the stage and out of rehearsal for so long, to spend a little bit of time with this great material.
And Arthur, I mean, there's a touch of the old fit-ups in some ways about this, but this idea of actually getting out, you know, performing live in front of an audience, the audience numbers may be reduced for safety, et cetera, but it's actual theatre happening in front of people. It must be great to be thinking about doing that.
Oh, I'm really looking forward to that. It's such a blessing to be able to do it. And with such an amazing play. I mean, you say the fit-ups. And also, I mean, it wouldn't be that far removed from the way it would have been staged in Shakespeare's Globe.
It might get Conor to explain that a little bit further in terms of how the van itself becomes a stage, but you also have an acting area in front of it. Just explain how that's going to work in this production, Conor.
So it is very much the back of a van, and we have a platform that folds out from that. It's all built in, and so we can travel very easily. So we'll go wherever anybody wants us to go. But we perform on the back of the van itself is like a stage, and then we have steps either side so we can come down onto the ground while, of course, staying at least 2 metres away from any unsuspecting audience members. So it is very much outdoors in the daylight, just as Shakespeare's plays would have been done in their own time.
Yeah, and as you were saying then, Arthur, that idea that it's almost as if, I think you as King Lear, do you stay in the van for most of the time? Are you up in that kind of what would be the balcony area in Shakespeare's Globe?
Yeah, not all the time, but it is kind of my base. That's the area of the stage the audience will associate with Lear. It's where my throne is, and that's my base of operations, and I do wander away from there during the storm and all that, but that's my space. Yeah.
Now, you and I may have soldiered at various times in the past on various tours and on various stages, Arthur. But soon enough for you to be coming towards King Lear, it's quite a task to take that role on. You're still a young man because you're still around my age.
Well, the last year has taken its toll on us. not least me. So yeah, I think I have white hair and a few wrinkles, and I have hopefully enough energy to do it. That's a few of the bases covered anyway. Yeah, it's as Connor has pointed out to us during rehearsals, that Lear is one of those conundrum parts that by the time you're old enough to play it, you're too old to play it in many cases. So it is a tricky beast.
Yeah, and what you're giving us here, Connor, have you chosen the key scenes? Doing that with any Shakespearean play is quite a task. Now, I know you had done it, obviously, with Romeo and Juliet last year, but choosing those scenes must have been quite a task, because inevitably there'll be something left out that people will say, oh, did you not put that in?
Absolutely. And it's a play full of, you know, to pick the greatest hits of King Lear is a fool's errand, because there's an awful lot of it that's very, very good. But what we've done is, well, what I did was, before we started rehearsal, reduce it to about a half an hour, maybe a little over that. I had a chat with a couple of English teachers, because we are aiming to bring this to some schools, and I wanted it to be useful. So that, you know, it's all very well for me to have a notion of what's interesting in King Lear, but if it's not going to be relevant to what they're discussing in their classes, what we want to do is make it alive and bring to them the bits that they've been reading, and that for them to see it performed. So I listened carefully to that, and we do have more or less the complete story of the play. A couple of characters had to fall by the wayside, but for the most part, all the good bits are definitely there.
Do we get, I know there's a storm there, do we get blow wind and crack your cheeks? Did I hear that that might not be present, or are you going to reinstate it, or what's happening there?
Your spies are efficient. That was one that did get caught. Simply because everybody knows that bit, Sean, and you said it beautifully yourself. But we figured that there are other corners of the play that might be worth putting on for our audiences today.
And there will be a storm, or there will be some kind of representation of that side of things, which is, I suppose, more vital to the overall role. You're going to give us a little bit of Lear, Arthur, the reason not
sure.
The reason not the need speech. You might just give us the context here. His Cordelia is the daughter that he should be listening to all along, and who should just get out there and say, you know, I love you, Dad. If she'd do that, there'd be a lot less problems. But his two older daughters, Gonril and Regan, you wouldn't want to have them minding you in your old age, would you?
No, and this is when they have banded together to give him a hard time. They've separately given him a hard time already, and now it's two against one. And their real bone of contention is his entourage of 100 knights, which probably is a little troublesome to have 100 noisy knights staying in your castle. So they're saying, well, why do you need 100? Maybe why do you even need 50? Eventually, why even one? Why do you need that? So this is Lear's response.
So what you've done for us then, Arthur, is that rather than doing this live on a phone line, you've got to use a proper quality mic at home, and you've made a recording of that speech for us from King Lear. So this is Arthur Reardon with Reason Not the Need from Shakespeare's King Lear.
Oh, reason not the need. Our basest beggars are in the poorest things superfluous. Allow not nature more than nature needs. Man's life is as cheap as a beast's. Thou art a lady. If only to go warm were gorgeous, why, nature needs not what thou gorgeous wear'st, which scarcely keeps thee warm. But for true need, you heavens, give me that patience. Patience I need. You see me here, you gods, a poor old man, as full of grief as age, wretched in both. If it be you that stirred these daughters' hearts against their father, fool me not so much to bear it tamely. Touch me with noble anger, and let not women's weapons, water drops, stain my man's cheeks. No, you unnatural hags, I will have such revenges on you both that all the world shall... I will do such things. What they are yet I know not, but they shall be the terrors of the earth. You think I'll weep? No, I'll not weep. I have full cause of weeping, but this heart shall break into 100,000 flaws, or ere I'll weep. Ah, oh, fool, I shall go mad.
And then he does.
He sure does. That's Arthur Reardon as King Lear. And this is in the version that'll be going around with Festival in a Van. Arthur and director Conor Hanratty speaking to me about it this evening. The other thing that I love about that you're doing with this, Conor, is after that speech, for example, you know, the first thing I'd want to say to Gonril and Regan is, would you not just, you know, give him a little bit of space? He looked after you. He gave you a great chunk of his kingdom. Look after him a little bit now. You allow the actors on stage to come out of character and actually have that type of discussion.
Absolutely. We as we were developing it, the artificiality of our editing is real. You know, we have absolutely chopped up the play. So to try and make a feature of that and acknowledge that, at a couple of key moments, we have them kind of questioning what's going on. The biggest moment for me in the play is Cordelia, as you say. Why can she not just turn around and play the game and say, "Yes, Father, I love you dearly"? So we actually have the actor step out and go, "Why doesn't she do this?" And they argue among themselves and then they snap back into it. Just because if I were, when I am reading or studying this play, you do kind of sit and go, "Why doesn't she?"
Exactly, yeah. And I guess that's great in terms of the actors as well, Arthur, because it in the rehearsal process, it's the sort of discussions that you would have. You're trying to work out why these things are and aren't happening.
Absolutely, yeah. It saves a little time in rehearsals. Taking a step back from the play, I think it sort of lets the audience into the play as well. You know, they feel drawn into this discussion too.
Yeah, and the hope would be that the questions and the discussions you're having on stage are the very ones that they're asking of their teachers.
Might be relevant.
Every single day. Listen, thanks to both of you for being with us this evening. That's Conor Hanratty and Arthur Reardon. And for more details on this performance of King Lear and where it will be and when, go to festivalinavan.com.
You're listening to Arena.
And just 11 minutes to 8 now on Wednesday night's Arena. It's been one of the most talked about TV shows of recent years, and The Handmaid's Tale is now back for a fourth series. The drama is, of course, based on the landmark Margaret Atwood novel of the same name, but the TV version has now diverged completely from the source material. At the end of the last series, June and the other handmaids successfully got a plane load of children out of Gilead, but at considerable cost, as June herself was shot in the process. Series 4 is up and running since last month in the US, and RTE is about to start transmitting it here on this side of the Atlantic starting tomorrow night, in fact on RTE2 television at 10:30. Jen Gannon has been taking a look at the previews for us, and she joins me now. When you go back, Jen, to 2017 and think of the splash that The Handmaid's Tale made at that time, it was phenomenal. It was a phenomenon.
It felt like this wry commentary about the political landscape at the time, and almost the handmaids' red cloaks were matching Trump's, you know, red hats, and it had the religious conservatism of the Trump administration. It felt like it was reflecting that through this funhouse mirror to this, you know, the merciless, misogynistic Republic of Gilead. And at that time, you had the Women's March in Washington, the revelations of the Me Too movement, and our own repeal campaign, and they all felt like there were these moments that were bound up in the drama. It felt like, you know, the right show coming at the right time. And because the first season stuck so closely to Margaret Atwood's book, it was all about the dismantling of civil liberties and the terrifying ease that women's rights were decimated in this, you know, religious fundamentalist society that were obsessed with procreation. So it did feel very close to a lot of movements that were happening at that time.
And indeed, there were those who adopted the attire of the handmaids, those, you know, those beautiful red cloaks and striking white bonnets, and that in itself, the wearing of those became a statement.
That imagery was a huge deal at that time, but I think, you know, that we've moved on, and it's 4 years later and we've had 3 seasons, and it's definitely diverged from its source material,
sure,
as you said. And to be honest, like, for something that we had so much hope for and a lot of critical acclaim as well as a huge viewership, The Handmaid's Tale, it's turned into this kind of endurance test. I think for seasons 2 and 3, I think there was this endless brutality to it, that it just felt like this relentless conveyor belt of different styles of torture that wouldn't have looked out of place in a Saw exploitation, you know, film, a horror film.
Because I think so many people, we were all excited. The first season was such a success. We were delighted that there was going to be a second season, and that it was going to diverge and go off somewhere new from the source material, Atwood's source material. But then when season three came, I think a lot of people were just worn down by the nature of the constant trauma that we were watching.
Yeah, I mean, I think viewers, you really had to ask yourself as a viewer, why were you still engaging with this story that at its base level really just amounted to trauma porn? And there really wasn't any satisfaction in seeing June. She was thwarted at every turn. And the storylines did feel very repetitive and weak. It kind of, the overarching message of the wider context of about society and their struggles had been kind of just absorbed into this repetitive internal conflict between Offred, June, and her tormentors, the Waterfords. And, you know, Serena Joy had gotten Nick, June's lover, involved in getting June pregnant. And then the commander, played by Joseph Fiennes, was dangerously infatuated with June. And it just became this psychosexual soap opera instead of being this great dynamic show that it used to be. It became, for me, I said it was like Under His Eyes Wide Shut, instead of like this political drama.
Yeah, because Under His Eyes has been one of the great phrases, of course, of the series. Let's kind of get where we are then. Season four has a lot to do then to pull viewers back in, I would have thought. What do we need to know at the beginning of season four? Where are we?
Well, I mean, we know that, as you said, she put all 83 children on the flight to Canada. And I think for me, it would have been more believable if that had been the end of June's story, if she had died with this sacrifice and they'd let someone else take over and trying to form some kind of rebel resistance army. Instead of, they've turned June into this kind of one-woman Terminator, and she's surviving these multiple physical and psychological traumas to exact her revenge. She has this superhero style resilience now, which is a little bit, unbelievable. But with that, if you have persevered through the previous seasons, I can confirm that you will be compensated to some degree in season four. If you felt there was no relief or escape from the horrors of Gilead, this season gives you this emotional payback that you really do need. And it's building to something greater. There were moments of retribution in season three, but I think in season four, the show has a new momentum and it's moving towards this final battle of Gilead or its inevitable destruction, which feels like something at least.
Right, I'm listening to a clip now, and this is all of the women are now disguised. All of the handmaids that are disguised as Marthas, who are the sort of the maids, if you like, the cookers in the house, the cooks in the houses. They're at a safe house. The rebel housemaids sit down to a meal, and a new character here, Mrs. Keyes, played by McKenna Grace, who's a traumatised child bride, harasses poor Janine, played by Madeleine Brewer, as they eat.
Oh, I'll take it.
Take one, Janine.
Oh, no. Thank you.
Ma'am. I had to kill that pig to feed you all. She'd still be alive if you weren't here. So? Life is precious on a farm, Janine. Don't spit that out! Mrs. Keyes.
And there, if you thought that the oppressiveness was going to go away just because they were in a safe house, well, forget about it. That's a scene from season four, episode one of season four of The Handmaid's Tale. Jen Gannon with us speaking about it this evening. McKenna Grace, that new character is going to be important, I think, as this season progresses, to this Mrs. Keyes, very young character, Jen.
Yeah, she's only around 15 or 16 or around that age. And there is a huge plot line with her, not to give any spoilers, but because the girls are hiding out in the remote farm, there is a sense of this kind of, they've turned into almost Manson girls. There's this menace and wildness to them, which is great to see because they're kind of gleeful in their violence that they exact out on any of the strangers trying to attack the farm. And you do, it feels almost joyful, the violence in it. But you know that it can't last, that, June, they're putting themselves in danger. And June is also, she can be a danger to the women she's supposed to be fighting for. And I think that dichotomy in her character still makes it compelling viewing. And also there is, thankfully, a greater concentration on what's happening outside of Gilead. about those, the stories of those who fled to Canada and how they're adapting to their lives and the complications that the children and adults face who escaped Gilead. And I think stepping up to the plate, you know, we have Alexis Bledel who plays Emily, and I think she's just truly grown in strength as a character, and Samira Wiley as June's friend Moira. They're both the extensions of their character, character's range is great in this season.
It still depends though so much of it on Elizabeth Moss as Amos, as the character of June.
Yeah, I just think, well, you can't take your eyes off her, and her performance is stunning. And, you know, there's a distinctive look to The Handmaid's Tale that's full of these punishing, intrusive, claustrophobic close-ups of her face. And it creates this unique intimacy between June and the viewer that Elizabeth Moss definitely plays upon, because you almost feel with the close eye contact, it feels very uncomfortable sometimes and unbearable. Like, we are co-conspirators in her suffering, and we see her, you know, cry right into the camera or leer like a kind of Jack Nicholson style right into the camera when she's exacting revenge. And it does make an intense viewing, and I think that's a very special performance that she really does.
And Aunt Dowd is still there as Aunt Lydia.
I love Aunt Dowd as Aunt Lydia, because I think she adds a kind of campy John Waters dimension to it, even though she is a repugnant character, but there's also this kind of deep campiness to her as well, which I enjoy.
Yeah, one of the things I've only seen the first episode of this new series, but there's a bit of tension, a lot of tension towards the end as a chap happens upon the farm. Now, he has been a bad chap, let's face it, but the tension in that scene is quite extraordinary. And there are other scenes too where the Nick Blaine character Max Minghella and the Bradley Whitford character Joseph Lawrence, we're still very unsure who are the goodies and who are the baddies. They seem to be ramping up maybe that tension of who's double crossing who. Will that hold our attention for the series, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the problem with this is, like, the show, I like that the show is not just bound up with June's plans for dismantling Gilead, and the impending war it's more focused on, and they're showing the effects of the rebellion psychologically on people, and the trust factor as well, that you don't know where what's going to happen in that way. And it has gained a new lease of life because of that. And I do think they're the most well-constructed episodes since the first season. But we are aware that there's a fifth and final season happening. So knowing that there's another season kind of fills me with dread, because it would indicate that all this progress that has been made may be for naught, and that we're going to go right back to Gilead again.
But you are saying give season four a go. If you give up after season three, maybe give it a go and see how you feel. It's worth checking it out. That's Jen Gannon there. Season four of The Handmaid's Tale starts tomorrow night, Thursday, RTÉ2 Television, at 10:30 in the evening. That is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy researched. Janice Murphy was the broadcast coordinator. Gar Duffy was on sound this evening, and tonight's programme was produced by Kay Shee. Back with you tomorrow night once again, 7:00 here on RTÉ Radio.